Antiquities, Book 5. 1. How Joshua, the general of the Hebrews, made war on the Canaanites, defeated them, destroyed some of them, and divided the land by lot among the tribes. 2. How, after the general's death, the Israelites transgressed their ancestral laws and suffered great disasters, and how, in the civil strife that followed, the tribe of Benjamin was destroyed except for 600 men. 3. How, after this calamity, God enslaved them to the Assyrians for their impiety. 4. The liberation brought to them through Senes, son of Athniel, who ruled for 40 years and is called by both Greeks and Phoenicians a judge. 5. How our people again served the Moabites for 18 years and were freed from servitude by a certain Judes, who then held power for 80 years. 6. How, having been enslaved by the Canaanites for 20 years, they were freed by Barak and Deborah, who ruled them for 40 years. 7. How the Amalekites made war on the Israelites, defeated them, and ravaged the land for 7 years. 8. How Gideon freed them from the Amalekites and ruled the people for 40 years. 9. How, after him, many successors made war for a long time on the surrounding nations. 10. Concerning the courage of Samson, and how much harm he caused the Philistines. 11. How the sons of Eli the priest were slain in battle against the Philistines. 12. How their father, hearing of the disaster, fell from his throne and died. 13. How the Philistines, victorious in that war, captured the Hebrews. Ark 14. How all who ruled from Senes onward were called judges. This book covers a period of 470 years. Moses had passed from among men in the manner already described, and Joshua, once all the customary rites for him had been completed and the mourning had subsided, ordered the people to make ready for a campaign. He sent spies to Jericho to learn the strength of its inhabitants and their intentions, while he himself reviewed the army in preparation for crossing the Jordan when the moment came. He summoned the leaders of the tribe of Reuben and the chief men of Gad and of Manasseh, for half of this last tribe too had been permitted to settle in the land of the Amorites, a seventh part of Canaan, and reminded them of what they had promised Moses, urging them, out of regard for his care of them, even as he lay dying, and for the common good, to show themselves eager to carry out what was commanded. Following them with 50,000 men at arms, Joshua marched from Abel to the Jordan, a distance of 60 stadia. As soon as the camp was pitched, the spies arrived, having missed nothing of what concerned the Canaanites. On first entering the city, they had freely observed the whole of it, noting which sections of the wall were strong and which were not so well secured, and which of the small gates, being weak, offered a way in for the army. The inhabitants they met paid them no heed, supposing that they were examining everything closely out of a foreigner's curiosity about the city's history, not with hostile intent. But when evening came, the spies withdrew to a lodging near the wall, and there, having eaten, they were beginning to think only of how to get away, when word reached the king, who was at dinner, that certain men had come from the camp of the Hebrews to spy out the city and were lodging, with great care to remain unnoticed, at the house of Rahab. He at once sent men with orders to seize and bring them, so that he might question them under torture and learn what they wanted, coming as they had. When Rahab learned of their approach, she happened to be drying bundles of flax on the roof. She hid the spies among these, and told the men sent by the king that some strangers, unknown to her, had indeed dined at her house shortly before sunset and had since left. If the city found them alarming, or if they had come posing any danger to the king, it would be easy to overtake and seize them as they fled. The men, thus deceived by the woman, suspected no trick and left without searching the lodging. When those who had set out after the spies, along the roads by which they supposed them most likely to be making their escape, and especially those leading down to the river, found no trace of them anywhere, they gave up the pursuit. Once the commotion had died down, Rahab brought the men down and told them of the danger she had taken on herself for their safety. For if she were caught hiding them, she would not escape the king's punishment, but would perish miserably along with her whole household. She begged them to remember, once they had gained control of the land of Canaan, to repay her for the deliverance she had now provided, and told them to go home, but first to swear that they would indeed save her and all that belonged to her when they took the city and destroyed everyone in it according to the decree they had made. For she knew, she said, by signs taught her by God, that this would happen. The men acknowledged their gratitude for what she had done for them, and swore that they would repay her indeed for it. They advised her that when she perceived the city was about to be taken, she should gather her possessions and all her household into the lodging and shut them in, hanging a scarlet cloth before the doors, so that the general, recognizing the house, would take care not to harm it. "For we will make this known to him," they said, "being eager that what is yours be spared. But if any of your people should fall in the fighting, you must not hold it against us, and we ask God, whom we have sworn by, not to be angry with us as men who have broken their oath." Having agreed to these terms, they made their way out by letting themselves down through the wall, and, reaching their own people safely, reported all they had done and seen in the city. Joshua then told the high priest Eleazar and the council of elders what the spies had agreed with Rahab, and they ratified the oath. The army was afraid to cross the river, for the Jordan was running high and could not be crossed by bridges, none having ever been built over it before. Nor did they think they would have leisure, with the enemy at hand, to build one now, and no boats were to be had. But God promised to make the river passable for them by reducing its volume. Waiting 2 days, Joshua then led the army and the whole multitude across in the following manner. The priests went first, carrying the ark. After them came the Levites, bearing the tabernacle and the vessels used in the sacrifices. Behind the Levites followed the whole company arranged by tribes, with the children and women in the middle, out of fear that they might be swept away by the current. When the priests, the first to step in, found the river passable, its depth having been checked, and its gravel bed, since the current was neither deep nor swift, lying firm enough to bear their weight in place of solid ground, everyone crossed the river confidently, seeing it become exactly what God had foretold it would be. The priests stood in the middle of the riverbed until the whole multitude had crossed and reached safety. Once all had crossed, the priests came out as well, and the current, now released, resumed its natural course. No sooner had the Hebrews stepped out of it than the river swelled again and regained its normal size. Advancing 50 stadia, they pitched camp 10 stadia from Jericho. There Joshua set up an altar of stones, each carried up from the riverbed by one of the tribal leaders at the prophet's command, as a memorial of the stopping of the current, and offered sacrifice on it to God. They kept the Passover in that place, now enjoying in abundance everything of which they had previously been short, for they harvested the Canaanites' grain, already ripe, and drove off the rest of the plunder as well. And it was then, too, that the manna, on which they had lived for 40 years, failed them. When the Israelites did all this, and the Canaanites did not come out to meet them, but stayed shut up behind their walls, Joshua resolved to besiege them. On the first day of the festival, the priests carried the ark around the city, with a body of armed men guarding it in a circle, marching ahead and sounding 7 horns to rouse the army's courage. They went around the wall with the elders following, and once the priests alone had sounded their horns, for they did nothing more than this, they returned to camp. They did the same for 6 days, and on the 7th Joshua assembled the armed men and the whole people, and announced to them the good news that the city would fall that day. For God would bring down its walls on their behalf, without any effort of their own. He instructed them nonetheless to kill anyone they found, without growing weary of the slaughter of the enemy, without yielding to pity, and without letting greed for plunder allow any of the enemy to escape. They were to destroy every living creature, taking nothing for their own use, but whatever silver and gold there was they were to gather and set aside as a special first portion for God from the first city taken, since it belonged to him by right of conquest. Rahab alone, with her family, was to be spared, because of the oaths the spies had sworn to her. Having said this and drawn up the army, he led it against the city. Once again they went around it, the ark leading and the priests rousing the army to the task with their horns. When they had gone around 7 times and paused for a little, the wall collapsed, with no engine or other force brought against it by the Hebrews. Entering Jericho, they killed everyone, the inhabitants being too stunned by the extraordinary collapse of the wall and too broken in spirit to defend themselves. They were cut down in the streets and overtaken in their houses. Nothing spared them, all perished, down to the women and children, and the city was filled with corpses, with no one escaping. They burned the whole city and the surrounding country. Rahab, who had fled with her household to the lodging, was saved by the spies, and Joshua, when she was brought before him, acknowledged his gratitude for having saved the spies' lives and told her that his repayment for this kindness would prove no less generous. He at once granted her fields and held her in the highest honor. Whatever the fire had spared of the city, he razed to the ground, and he pronounced curses on anyone who should undertake to rebuild it, so that whoever laid the foundations of its walls should lose his firstborn son, and whoever completed them should lose his youngest. The divine power did not neglect this curse, as we shall relate later when we come to what happened concerning it. An immense quantity of silver, gold, and bronze was gathered from the captured city, no one having transgressed the decree or plundered any of it for private gain, but all having abstained from it as already consecrated to God. This Joshua handed over to the priests to store in the treasuries. Such was the fate of Jericho. Now a certain Achar, son of Zebedeus, of the tribe of Judah, having found a royal robe woven entirely of gold and a mass of gold weighing 200 shekels, and thinking it a hard thing to give up for the use of God, who had no need of it, a gain he had risked his life to win, dug a deep pit in his own tent and buried it there, supposing he could hide it from God as easily as from his fellow soldiers. The place where Joshua had pitched camp was called Gilgal, a name meaning freedom. For once they had crossed the river, they knew themselves free at last both from the Egyptians and from the hardship of the wilderness. A few days after the disaster of Jericho, Joshua sent 3,000 armed men against Naiah, a city lying beyond Jericho, to take it. But when the men of Naiah engaged them, the Hebrews were routed and lost 36 men. When this was reported to the Israelites, it caused great grief and terrible despondency, not so much on account of the men lost, though all of them had been good men and worthy of honor, as out of sheer despair. For having believed themselves already masters of the land and assured, by God's own promise, that their army would come through its battles unharmed, they now saw the enemy unexpectedly emboldened. They put on sackcloth over their clothes and spent the whole day in tears and mourning, seeking no food, and felt the blow all the more heavily for that reason. Seeing the army thus terrified and already forming grim expectations for the whole enterprise, Joshua spoke boldly to God. "We were not led on by any presumption of our own," he said, "to bring this land under arms, but by Moses your servant, who roused us to this task, to whom you promised, by many proofs, that you would give us this land and would always make our army stronger in arms than the enemy. Some things have indeed turned out for us according to your promises. But now, having stumbled contrary to our expectation and lost some of our force, we are troubled at the thought that your word and what Moses foretold might not be secure, and the fear of what is to come distresses us all the more for having met with such a first trial. But you, Master, for it lies in your power to find a cure for these ills, grant us victory now to relieve our present distress, and remove from our minds this despair concerning what is to come." Saying this, Joshua fell on his face and entreated God. God answered that he should rise and purify the army, for a pollution had come upon it, a theft having been committed of property consecrated to him, and that this was the cause of their present defeat. But that once the man who had done it was found out and punished, victory over their enemies would always be theirs. Joshua reported this to the people, and, summoning Eleazar the high priest and the leading men, cast lots by tribe. When the guilty tribe was thereby the tribe of Judah pointed to itself, and the lot was cast again by clans within it, and the truth of the wrongdoing was found to lie with the kin of Achar. When the search proceeded man by man, they seized Achar, who, unable to deny it once God had closed every way of escape around him, confessed the theft and produced the stolen goods in full view. He was put to death at once, and that same night received the dishonorable burial fitting a condemned man. Joshua purified the army and led it out against Naiah. By night he set ambushes around the city himself, and at dawn he engaged the enemy. When they came on boldly, emboldened by their earlier victory, he feigned retreat, and by this device drew them far from the city, since they supposed they were pursuing him and, flushed with the prospect of victory, grew careless. Then he wheeled his force about and faced them, and by signals prearranged with the men in ambush, roused them too into the battle. They rushed into the city while its defenders were occupied at the walls, some of them even distracted by watching the fighting outside. So one group took the city and killed everyone they met, while Joshua forced back those who had come to close quarters with him and put them to flight. Driven together as though toward an untouched city, but seeing it already taken and burning, women and children within it too, they scattered through the fields, unable to help one another for being isolated. Such was the disaster that overtook the people of Nea. A multitude of children was taken captive, along with women, servants, and other possessions beyond counting, and the Hebrews seized herds of livestock and great sums of money, for the place was wealthy. All of this Joshua distributed among the soldiers once he reached Gilgal. The people of Jibon, who lived nearest to Jerusalem, saw what had befallen Jericho and Nea and suspected that the same disaster would soon reach them. They decided not to appeal to Joshua, since they did not expect to obtain any fair terms from a man waging a war of extermination against the whole Canaanite nation. Instead, they called on their neighbors, the men of Chephra and Kiriath-Jearim, to join them in an alliance, telling them that they too would not escape the danger if the Israelites captured Jibon first. And together the allies resolved to slip away from the main body of the Israelite force. When the Chephirites and Kiriath-Jearimites accepted this proposal, the Jibonites sent envoys to Joshua to negotiate a treaty of friendship, choosing for the task those citizens they judged best able to secure what was advantageous for their people. Since they thought it dangerous to admit they were Canaanites, believing that they could escape the danger only by claiming no kinship whatsoever with the Canaanites, but rather that they lived very far from them. They said they had come because of a report of Joshua's valor that had reached them after a long journey, and they pointed to their own appearance as proof of the claim. Their clothes, they said, had been new when they set out, but were now worn through by the length of the road. In fact, they had deliberately put on ragged garments to lend credibility to their story. Standing before the assembly, they declared that they had been sent by the Jibonites and by the towns around them, all lying at a great distance from this land, in order to make friendship with the Israelites on the terms traditional among their people. For they had learned that by God's favor and gift, the Israelites had been granted possession of the land of the Canaanites, and they said they were glad of this and asked to be admitted as fellow citizens. As they spoke, displaying the proofs of their journey, they urged the Hebrews to make a treaty and friendship with them. Joshua, believing what they said that they did not belong to the Canaanite nation, made peace with them, and Eleazar the high priest, together with the council of elders, swore that the Israelites would treat them as friends and allies and would do them no wrong, the people confirming the oath by their assent. So the envoys, having gained what they wanted by deceit, went back to their own people. Joshua then marched against the Canaanites of the hill country, and there learned that the Jibonites, who lived not far from Jerusalem, in fact belonged to the Canaanite race. He summoned their leaders and charged them with the deception. Since they had no other plea for their safety than this very deceit, and had been driven to it out of necessity, he called together the high priest Eleazar and the council of elders. And when these judged that the Jibonites should be made servants of the state, on condition that the oath not be broken, Joshua confirmed them as such. This was the safeguard and security the Jibonites secured for themselves in the disaster that had overtaken them. The king of Jerusalem was furious that the Jibonites had gone over to Joshua, and he called on the kings of the neighboring nations to join him in a war against them. When the Jibonites saw these four kings encamped with their forces beside a spring near their city, preparing for a siege, they called on Joshua, their ally, for help. For their situation was such that they expected to perish at the hands of these kings, yet hoped to be saved by those who had set out to destroy the whole Canaanite race, on the strength of the friendship now sworn between them. Joshua hurried to their aid with his whole army, marching day and night, and at dawn engaged the enemy. When they broke and fled, he pursued them down the sloping ground toward the place called Beth-horon. There he learned of God's cooperation, made evident through peals of thunder, bolts of lightning, and a downpour of hail heavier than usual. And further, the day itself was lengthened beyond its natural span, so that night would not fall and check the eagerness of the Hebrews. It happened in this way that Joshua caught the kings hiding in a cave near Makkedah and put them all to death. That the length of the day was then increased and extended beyond its accustomed measure is recorded in the writings preserved in the temple. With the forces of the kings who had marched against the Jibonites thus crushed, Joshua returned again to the hill country of Canaan, and after a great slaughter of its inhabitants and the seizure of much plunder, came back to the camp at Gilgal. As the report of Hebrew valor spread widely among the surrounding peoples, and the number of the dead struck terror into all who heard of it, the kings of the Canaanites who dwelt around Mount Lebanon, together with the Canaanites of the plains, joined with the Philistines and encamped near the city of Beeroth, not far from Kedesh in Upper Galilee. This territory too belongs to Galilee. The whole army numbered 300,000 infantry, 10,000 horsemen, and 20,000 chariots. The sheer size of this enemy force struck fear into Joshua and the Israelites, and their confidence in a favorable outcome wavered, so overwhelming was their dread. But God rebuked them for their fear and asked what more they could want beyond the help he had already given them. And he promised that he would defeat their enemies, commanding them to disable the horses and burn the chariots. Emboldened by God's promises, Joshua set out against the enemy, and on the fifth day he came upon them and joined battle. A fierce fight followed, with a slaughter greater than words can convey to those who hear of it. Joshua pressed the pursuit a very long way and destroyed the entire enemy army, but for a few survivors, and all the kings fell. So that once there were no more men left to kill, Joshua had the horses slaughtered and the chariots burned. He then marched through the country unopposed, no one daring to come out and fight, but took the cities by siege instead, killing everyone he captured. 5 years had now passed, and not a single Canaanite remained except for those who had escaped behind the strength of fortified walls. Joshua broke camp from Gilgal, moved into the hill country, and set up the sacred tabernacle at the city of Shiloh, judging the place suitable for its beauty, until such time as circumstances would allow them to build a temple there. From there he went on to Shechem with the whole people and set up an altar at the place Moses had foretold, dividing the army so that half stood on Mount Gerizim and half on Mount Ebal, where the altar itself and the Levites and priests were stationed. After offering sacrifices and pronouncing the curses, they left these inscribed on the altar and returned to Shiloh. By now Joshua was an old man. Seeing that the Canaanite cities were hard to capture, both because of the natural strength of their sites and the might of their walls, defenses the Canaanites had thrown up in expectation that the enemy, learning of the Israelites' departure from Egypt, would give up any hope of taking the cities by siege, and so had spent all that time fortifying them. He gathered the people in assembly at Shiloh and summoned them. When they had eagerly come together, he reminded them of all that had already been achieved and of the deeds accomplished, declaring these the finest of deeds, worthy both of the divine power that had granted them and of the excellence of the laws they followed. He pointed out that 31 kings who had dared to meet them in battle had been overcome, and that every army that had ever put its confidence in its own strength and joined battle with them had been destroyed, so completely that not even a remnant of their descendants survived. As for the remaining cities, since some had already been captured, but others required time and a great siege because of the strength of their walls and the confidence their inhabitants placed in them, he asked that those who had come across from the far side of the Jordan to join in the campaign and share its dangers, being kinsmen, now be released to go home, in recognition of what they had endured together. And that one man from each tribe, distinguished for merit, be sent to measure the land faithfully and honestly, doing no wrong, so as to report to the rest its extent without deceit. Having made this proposal, Joshua found the people in agreement, and he sent out men to measure their territory, giving them assistants skilled in geometry, whose training would make it impossible for them to falsify the truth. He instructed them to assess separately the measure of the fertile land and of the less productive. For the nature of the land of Canaan is such that one would see great plains capable of bearing abundant crops, land that, compared with other country, would be reckoned altogether blessed, yet when set beside the territory of Jericho or of Jerusalem would appear as nothing. And yet the whole extent of their land is quite small, and much of it hill country. Still, for the raising and quality of its crops, it yields to none other. For this reason, he judged that the allotments ought to be reckoned by value rather than by simple measure, since a single plethron of land might sometimes be worth as much as 1,000 elsewhere. The men who had been sent out, 10 in number, traveled the land, assessed its value, and in the 7th month returned to him at the city of Shiloh, where the tabernacle had been set up. Joshua then took Eleazar, the council of elders, and the heads of the tribes, and distributed the land among the 9 tribes and the half-tribe of Manasseh, measuring the allotment for each tribe according to its size. When the lots were cast, the tribe of Judah, drawing the first lot, took the whole of Upper Idumea, stretching as far as Jerusalem and reaching in width to the Dead Sea. Within this allotment lay the cities of Ashkelon and Gaza. Simeon, which drew the second lot, received the part of Idumea bordering on Egypt and Arabia. The Benjaminites received the land stretching from the Jordan River to the sea in length, and in width bounded by Jerusalem and Bethel. This was the narrowest of the allotments because of the richness of its soil, for they received both Jericho and the city of Jerusalem. The tribe of Ephraim received the land extending to Jezer from the Jordan River, and as wide from Bethel as reaches to the Great Plain, while the half-tribe of Manasseh received the land from the Jordan to the city of Dor, and in width as far as Bethshean, now called Scythopolis. After these, Issachar received Mount Carmel and the river as the boundary of its length, and Mount Tabor as the boundary of its width. The Zebulunites received the territory extending to Genesareth and reaching to Carmel and the sea. The Asherites received the whole valley called by that same name from the Carmel range, extending toward Sidon. Their territory included the city of Ark, also called Ectopa. The regions facing east as far as the city of Damascus and the upper parts of Galilee were taken by the Naphtalites, as far as Mount Lebanon and the springs of the Jordan, which rise from the mountain at the point where the boundary runs along the northern side of the city of Ark. The Danites received the portion of the lowland facing west, bounded by Ashdod and Dor, taking in all of Jamnia and Gath, from Ekron to the mountain range where the territory of Judah began. So Joshua divided the land in this way among 6 nations descended from the sons of Canaan, and gave it to the 9.5 tribes to possess. For the land of the Amorites, likewise named after one of the sons of Canaan, Moses had already allotted earlier to the 2.5 tribes, as we have related before. The regions around Sidon, and the Arkites, Amathites, and Aradians, remained unorganized. Since old age now prevented Joshua from carrying out all that he might otherwise have conceived, and since those who would succeed him in leadership were careless of the common good, he charged each tribe to leave nothing remaining of the Canaanite race within the land allotted to it. For their safety and the preservation of their ancestral customs depended on this alone, as Moses had foretold, and as they themselves were convinced. He also directed that the 38 cities be given to the Levites, for they had already received 10 in the territory of the Amorites. Of these, he assigned 3 as places of refuge for fugitives to dwell in, for great was his care to leave nothing that Moses had ordained unfulfilled. To the tribe of Judah he assigned Hebron, to Ephraim Shechem, and to the tribe of Naphtali Kedesh, a place in Upper Galilee. He also distributed whatever was left of the plunder, and there was a great deal of it. Everyone, in common and individually, had come into possession of large amounts of gold, silver, clothing, and other furnishings, along with cattle in numbers too great to count. After this, Joshua gathered the army into an assembly, along with the men settled beyond the Jordan in the territory of the Amorites. 50,000 armed men had campaigned with him, and spoke as follows. Since God, the Father and Master of the Hebrew people, has given us this land to possess and has promised to preserve it as ours forever. And since you, at his command, gave yourselves wholeheartedly to helping us whenever we needed you, it is only right that you should now be released to rest, with no further hardship awaiting you, so that we may spare your zeal and have it fresh and undiminished should we ever need it again, rather than wearied by present labors and slower to respond in the future. For the dangers you shared with us, we will be grateful, not only now but always, being men who remember our friends and hold fast in our thoughts to what we owe them. That you postpone the enjoyment of your own blessings for our sake, and having toiled alongside us to secure what we now possess through God's favor, only then chose to claim your own share of it. And beyond the goods you already have, the toils we shared have brought abundant wealth, much plunder to carry home, gold and silver, and more besides, along with our goodwill and readiness to repay you however you wish. For you have not fallen short of anything Moses foretold, even after his death, out of contempt for him, nor is there anything for which we do not owe you thanks. So we release you gladly to your allotted portions, and we urge you not to regard our kinship as bounded by anything, nor, because a river now runs between us, to think of us as strangers rather than as Hebrews. For we are all descendants of Abraham, both those who live here and those who live there, and there is one God who brought both our ancestors and yours into being. Hold fast to the worship and the constitution of that God, which he himself established through Moses, keeping it in its entirety. For if you remain faithful to these things, God will show himself well disposed toward you and will fight on your side. But if you turn aside to imitate other nations, he will turn away from your people. Having said this, and having embraced the leaders individually and the whole multitude together, he himself remained behind, while the people escorted them on their way, not without tears, and they parted from one another only with difficulty. Once the tribe of Reuben and the tribe of Gad, together with those of the Manassites who had gone with them, had crossed the river, they set up an altar on the bank of the Jordan, meant as a monument for those to come and a symbol of their kinship with those settled on the other side. But when the tribes on the far side heard that those who had been released had set up an altar, they did not credit the intention with which it had actually been raised. Instead, believing a slander about impiety toward God plausible enough, that it had been done to introduce innovation and the worship of foreign gods, they took up arms, intending to cross the river to punish those who had built the altar for departing from ancestral custom. For it did not seem to them to be a matter for weighing kinship or the standing of those under suspicion, but only what God wills and how he wishes to be honored. So they set out to war in anger, but Joshua, the high priest Eleazar, and the council of elders restrained them, urging that they first test the intentions of the men in question with words, and only afterward, if they learned their purpose to be malicious, proceed against them with arms. They therefore sent as envoys to them Phinehas, son of Eleazar, and 10 men of standing among the Hebrews with him, to learn what had been in their minds when they crossed and set up the altar on the riverbank. When these men had crossed over and come to them, an assembly was gathered, and Phinehas rose and said that their offense was too great to be corrected merely by being rebuked in words and warned for the future. That instead of considering the enormity of the wrongdoing and rushing straight to arms and vengeance by force, however, out of regard for kinship, and because words might well bring them to their senses, the delegation had been arranged in this way, so that, once they had learned the reasoning that had led them to build the altar, they might not seem hasty in coming against them with weapons if the men's judgment in building the altar proved sound, and yet might justly take vengeance if the accusation were shown to be true. For we did not think it right, he said, that you, who have had experience of God's purposes and have been hearers of the laws he himself gave us, should be separated from us and now settled in your own portion, which you received by God's grace and his providence toward us, forget him, abandon the tabernacle and the ark, and, by setting up an altar of your own that is not our ancestral one, bring in foreign gods to join the evils of the Canaanites. Yet you will incur no wrong if you repent now and go no further in this madness, but instead show reverence and remembrance for our ancestral laws. But if you persist in your wrongdoing, we will not shrink from the labor owed to the laws, but will cross the Jordan and fight on their behalf, and before that, on God's behalf, considering you no different from the Canaanites, but corrupting yourselves just as they do. Do not imagine that, because you have crossed the river, you are beyond the reach of God's power. You are everywhere within it, and it is impossible to escape his authority or the judgment that follows from it. And if you think that your presence here is an obstacle to your good sense, nothing prevents you from redistributing the land and leaving even this portion to pasture flocks. You will do well to come to your senses, and while your wrongdoing is still recent, to change your course. And we beg you, for the sake of your children and your wives, not to force us to take vengeance upon you. So then, since your own safety and that of those dearest to you rests on the decision of this assembly, deliberate accordingly, judging it more to your advantage to yield to words than to await the trial of deeds and of war. When Phinehas had said all this, the leaders of the assembly and the whole multitude began to defend themselves against the charges brought against them, saying that they would never abandon their kinship with the others, nor had they set up the altar out of any spirit of innovation. Rather, they acknowledged one God, common to all the Hebrews, and the bronze altar before the tabernacle, on which they would offer their sacrifices. The altar they had now raised, on account of which suspicion had fallen on them, had not been set up for worship, but so that it might stand for all time as a token and proof of their kinship with the rest, and as a necessary reminder to be prudent and remain faithful to their ancestral ways, not as the beginning of any transgression, as had been suspected of them. Let God himself, they said, be a sufficient witness that this was our reason for building the altar. And so, thinking better of us, hold none of these things against us, offenses for which all who are of Abraham's race and who attempt new customs at variance with the accustomed way would rightly deserve destruction. When they had said this, Phinehas commended them, went back to Joshua, and reported to the people what they had said. Joshua, rejoicing that there was now no need to muster an army or lead them out to arms and war against kinsmen, offered thank offerings to God on their behalf. Then, having dismissed the multitude to their own allotted portions, Joshua himself remained living at Shechem. 20 years later, now extremely old, he summoned the men of highest standing from the cities, the magistrates, the council of elders, and as many of the people as he could gather. When they had come, he reminded them of all the benefits God had given them. And they were many, for people who had risen from a humble condition to such glory and prosperity, and urged them to keep to God's design toward them just as it stood, and to remain devoted to piety, since only through that would the divine remain their friend. For it was good, he said, that as he was now about to depart from life, he should leave them such counsel, and he asked that they keep his exhortation in memory. Having spoken these words to those present, he died, having lived 110 years. Of these, he spent 40 in the company of Moses, being instructed in what was useful, and after Moses' death, he served as commander for 25 years. He was a man lacking neither in understanding nor in the ability to set forth clearly to the multitude what he had conceived, but excelling in both, courageous and bold in the face of deeds and dangers, most skillful in managing affairs in time of peace, and a man whose virtue was suited to every occasion. He was buried in the city of Timnah, in the tribe of Ephraim. About this same time, the high priest Eleazar also died, leaving the priesthood to his son Phinehas. His monument and tomb are at Gabbatha. After the death of these men, Phinehas prophesied, according to the will of God, that the leadership for the destruction of the Canaanite nation should be given to the tribe of Judah, for the people were eager to learn what God thought best. Judah took Simeon's tribe as a partner, on condition that, once Simeon's tributaries were removed, the men of Simeon would do the same for the tribe of Judah in its own portion. The Canaanites, since affairs were then flourishing for them, awaited them near Bezek with a large army, having entrusted command to Adoni-Bezek, king of the people of Bezek, a name meaning Lord of the Bezekites, for in the Hebrew tongue Adoni means Lord. They hoped to overcome the Israelites because Joshua was dead. But when the Israelites met them, the two tribes I have mentioned fought brilliantly and killed more than 10,000 of them. Having routed the rest and pursued them, they captured Adoni-Bezek, who, after his hands and feet had been cut off by them, said that after all he was not going to escape the notice of God for what he had now suffered, things he had not hesitated to do to 72 kings before him. They carried him alive as far as Jerusalem, and when he died there, they buried him in the ground. They then went on capturing cities, and having taken a great many, they laid siege to Jerusalem. They took the lower city and, in time, killed all its inhabitants, but the upper city was difficult for them to capture, owing to the strength of its walls and the nature of the terrain. From there, they moved their camp to Hebron, and having taken it, they killed everyone in it. There still remained a race of giants, whose bodies were of such size and shape, quite unlike other men, that they were an astonishing sight and a terrifying thing to hear about. Even now their bones are on display, unlike anything that those who come to examine them are familiar with. This they gave to the Levites as a special privilege, together with the 2,000 cubits of surrounding land, while they gave the land itself to Caleb as a gift, in accordance with the commands of Moses. For Caleb had been one of the spies whom Moses sent into Canaan. They also gave land to the descendants of Jethro the Midianite, for he had been Moses' father-in-law, so that they might have a place to live, since they had left their own homeland to follow Moses and Israel, and had lived with them in the wilderness. The tribe of Judah and the tribe of Simeon took the cities in the hill country of Canaan, and of those in the plain and by the sea, Ashkelon and Ashdod. Gaza and Ekron escaped them, since these lay in flat country well supplied with chariots, which dealt harshly with anyone who attacked there. These tribes, then, having prospered greatly through their fighting, withdrew to their own cities and laid down their weapons. The Benjaminites, since Jerusalem belonged to them, allowed its inhabitants to remain there on condition of paying tribute. And so, once all of them had ceased, some from killing, others from being in danger, they had leisure to work the land. The rest of the tribes, following the example of Benjamin, did the same, and, content with the tribute paid to them, allowed the Canaanites to live without further war. The tribe of Ephraim, besieging Bethel, found no result worth the time and effort of the siege, but its men, though weary of the blockade, persisted in it. Then, having seized a man from the city who had come out for supplies, they gave him assurances that if he handed over the city, they would spare him and his relatives. He, on these terms, swore to deliver the city into their hands. And so, having betrayed it in this way, he was saved along with his household, while the rest killed all the inhabitants and took possession of the city. After this, the Israelites grew lax toward their enemies and turned instead to caring for the land and its cultivation. As their wealth increased, they grew careless through luxury and pleasure in material things and were no longer strict in their observance of the laws governing their commonwealth. Angered by this, the divine brought ruin upon them, first because they had, against his own judgment, spared the Canaanites, and then because the Canaanites, seizing their opportunity, would treat them with great cruelty. The Israelites themselves were ill-disposed toward what came from God and unwilling to fight, having received much from the Canaanites and grown soft, through their luxury, toward hardship. And it happened that their aristocratic government had already broken down. They no longer appointed councils of elders or any other office previously established by custom, but lived in the fields, devoted to the pleasure of making money. And because of this great license, terrible civil strife once again overtook them, and they were led into war with one another for a reason of the following kind. A Levite, one of the common people of the district of Ephraim, living there, took as his wife a young woman from Bethlehem, a town in the tribe of Judah. Being deeply in love with the woman and overcome by her beauty, he found himself unlucky, for she did not return his feelings in kind. As she grew estranged from him, and he, because of this, burned all the more with passion, constant quarrels arose between them, until finally the woman, worn down by these disputes, left her husband and went to her parents' house in the fourth month. The man, taking the loss of his love hard, came to his father-in-law's house, and having settled their disputes, was reconciled. He stayed there 4 days while her parents entertained him warmly, and on the fifth day, having decided to leave for home, he set out toward evening, for the parents were slow to release their daughter and kept drawing the day out. A servant went with them, and they had a donkey on which the woman rode. When they reached the vicinity of Jerusalem, having already traveled 30 stadia, the servant advised stopping somewhere for the night, so that nothing untoward might befall them while traveling after dark, especially since they were not far from hostile country, for the times often made even friendly places dangerous and suspect. But the plan did not please him, to lodge among foreigners. The city was Canaanite, and instead he insisted they press on 20 stadia farther to a city of their own people. His view prevailed, and he arrived at Jiba, in the territory of the tribe of Benjamin, when it was already late. No one at the marketplace invited him in as a guest, but an old man coming down from the fields, an Ephraimite by tribe who lived in Jiba, met him and asked who he was, and for what reason, now that it was already dark, he was making arrangements for his dinner. The man said he was a Levite, and that he was on his way home bringing a woman from her parents' house. He explained that his home was in the allotment of Ephraim. The old man, both because of their kinship and because they belonged to the same tribe, and because of the chance meeting, took him in to be his guest. But some young men of Jiba, having seen the woman in the marketplace and marveled at her beauty, once they learned she was lodging with the old man, despised his weakness and his small numbers, and came to the door. When the old man urged them to go away and not to use force or outrage, they demanded that he hand over the stranger woman to be rid of the matter. When the old man said she was his kinswoman and a Levite's wife, and that they would be doing terrible things, they made light of justice and mocked him, disregarding that they were sinning against the laws, and threatened to kill him for obstructing their desires. Driven to this extremity, and unwilling to see his guests outraged, he offered them his own daughter instead, saying that they would satisfy their desire more lawfully this way, without the outrage of violating guests, and that he himself would do no wrong to those he had received as guests, thinking this the better course. But since they yielded nothing of their eagerness for the stranger woman, and instead pressed all the more to seize her, the old man kept begging them to dare nothing unlawful, while they seized her, and giving themselves over still more to violent lust, dragged the woman off with them, and, after abusing her the whole night through, released her as day was beginning. Worn out by what had happened to her, she came to the lodging, and from grief at what she had suffered, and from shame that kept her from daring to come into her husband's sight, for she reckoned that he above all would find what had happened impossible to bear, she collapsed and gave up her life. Her husband, thinking his wife was sunk in a deep sleep, and suspecting nothing amiss, tried to wake her, meaning to comfort her with the thought that she had not given herself to her abusers by her own free choice, but that they had seized her when they came to the lodging. But when he learned she was dead, controlling himself in the face of so great a disaster, he laid the dead woman on the animal and brought her home. There he cut her body limb by limb into 12 parts and sent them to each of the tribes, instructing the bearers to say who was responsible for the woman's death and what outrage the tribe of Benjamin had committed. The Israelites, sickened both by the sight and by the report of what had been done by violence, having had no previous experience of such a thing, gathered at Shiloh in pure and righteous anger, and, assembled before the tabernacle, were ready at once to take up arms and treat the men of Gibeah as enemies. But the council of elders held them back, persuading them that they ought not to bring war so hastily against fellow tribesmen before first discussing the charges in words, since the law did not permit an army to be led even against foreigners without first sending an embassy, and making such an attempt to bring those judged to be in the wrong to a change of heart. It was better, therefore, to obey the law and send to the men of Gibeah demanding the guilty parties, and if they were handed over, to be content with their punishment, but if the Gibeonites showed contempt, then to take up arms against them. So they sent to the men of Gibeah, accusing the young men of what had been done to the woman, and demanding, for the sake of justice, that those who had done what was unlawful be handed over to die in the place of their victim. But the men of Gibeah neither surrendered the young men, and considered it shameful to obey the commands of others, judging themselves, out of fear of war, inferior to no one in arms, whether in numbers or in courage. They were, moreover, in great readiness, and the men of the other tribes joined in this resolve, conspiring with them to defend themselves against attack. When such an answer from the men of Gibeah was reported to the Israelites, they swore oaths that none of them would give a daughter in marriage to a man of Benjamin, and that they would march against them, being angrier at them than, as we have learned, our ancestors ever were toward the Canaanites. At once they led out against them an army of 400,000 hoplites. The Benjaminite force of hoplites numbered under 26,600, of whom about 500 were the finest slingers with the left hand, so that when battle was joined near Gibeah, the Benjaminites routed the Israelites, and about 22,000 of them fell, and perhaps more would have perished had not nightfall checked them and broken off the fighting. The Benjaminites withdrew rejoicing into the city, while the Israelites, dismayed by the defeat, withdrew to their camp. The next day, when they joined battle again, the Benjaminites prevailed once more, and 18,000 of the Israelites died. Fearing the slaughter, they abandoned their camp. Coming to the city of Bethel, which lay very near, and fasting there, on the following day they besought God, through Phinehas the high priest, to cease his anger against them and, satisfied with their two defeats, to grant them victory and mastery over their enemies. God promised this through the prophecy of Phinehas. Dividing the army into two parts, they set half an ambush by night around the city, while the other half engaged the Benjaminites, and when pressed hard, gave ground. The Benjaminites pursued the Hebrews as they fled slowly, wanting to draw them out entirely from the city, and followed as they withdrew, so that even the old men and the young left behind in the city ran out, despite their weakness, wanting to join in overpowering the enemy along with everyone else. But when they had gone far from the city, the Hebrews stopped fleeing, turned about, and took their stand for battle, raising for those lying in ambush the signal that had been agreed upon. Those in ambush rose up with a shout and attacked the enemy. The Benjaminites, realizing at once that they had been deceived, fell into confusion and, driven into a hollow, ravine-like place, were surrounded and shot down with javelins, so that all perished except 600. These banded together, closed ranks, and forced their way through the midst of the enemy, fled to the nearby hills, and seizing them, settled there. All the rest, about 25,000, were killed. The Israelites burned Jibba and put to death the women and the males not yet of fighting age. They did the same to the other cities of the Benjaminites. They were so inflamed with rage that, because Jabesh in Gilead had not joined them against the Benjaminites, they sent 12,000 men from their ranks and ordered them to destroy it. The men sent killed the fighting population of the city, along with the children and women, except for 400 virgins. So far had they been driven by anger, from grief over the woman together with the loss of their armed men. Then remorse seized them over the disaster that had befallen the Benjaminites, and they proclaimed a fast for them, even though they judged that the Benjaminites deserved to suffer for having sinned against the laws. And they summoned the 600 survivors, through envoys, for they had settled above a certain rock called Rimmon, in the wilderness. The envoys, since the disaster had befallen not them alone, but the envoys too had lost kinsmen, lamented and gently urged them to bear it and to come together again with the rest, and not to vote to bring about the utter destruction of the tribe of Benjamin, at least as far as depended on the Israelites. "We grant you," they said, "the land of the whole tribe, and whatever spoil you are able to carry off." The Benjaminites, since it had come about by God's judgment against themselves and through their own wrongdoing, changed their minds and came down to rejoin their ancestral tribe, obeying those who summoned them. The Israelites gave them the 400 virgins of Jabesh as wives, and deliberated about the remaining 200, so that they too might be supplied with wives and beget children. But since oaths had been sworn that no one would give a daughter in marriage to a man of Benjamin before the war, some advised setting the oaths lightly aside, since they had sworn in anger and not by considered judgment, and that they would do nothing contrary to God's will if they were able to save an entire tribe from the danger of destruction. For perjuries, they said, were harsh and dangerous, not when committed under necessity, but when ventured in wickedness. When the council of elders was troubled at the very word perjury, someone said he could tell them a way both to provide the men with wives and to keep the oaths. When they asked what he had in mind, he said, "Three times a year, when we gather at Shiloh, the women and daughters accompany us for the festival. Let it be permitted for the Benjaminites, by seizure, to marry whichever of these they are able to take, with us neither urging it nor forbidding it. And to their fathers, if they are aggrieved and demand punishment, we will say that they themselves are to blame for neglecting to guard their daughters, and that our anger against the Benjaminites ought to be relaxed, having already been exercised too much and too swiftly." Persuaded by this, they voted to allow the Benjaminites marriage by abduction. When the festival came, the 200 lay in wait in twos and threes before the city, in the vineyards and other places where they would go unnoticed, waiting for the virgins to pass by. The girls, playing and suspecting nothing of what was coming, walked along unguarded, and the men, once they had scattered, seized them as they rose up. Having married in this way, they went off to work the land and took thought to return once more to their former prosperity. Thus the tribe of Benjamin, which had been in danger of complete destruction in the way described, was saved by the wisdom of the Israelites, and at once flourished, making swift increase both in numbers and in everything else. This is how that war came to an end. Something similar to this befell the tribe of Dan as well, brought about for the following reason. Since the Israelites had by now abandoned the practice of war and devoted themselves to working the land, the Canaanites, despising them, joined forces together, expecting to suffer nothing themselves, and gaining firm hope of doing the Hebrews harm, they resolved to live in their cities thereafter in security. They prepared chariots and mustered their infantry, and their cities made common cause. From the tribe of Judah, they seized Ashkelon and Ekron and many other cities in the plain, and forced the Danites to take refuge in the hills, leaving them no foothold whatever in the plain. The Danites, being neither strong enough to make war nor possessed of sufficient land, sent 5 men of their number into the interior to reconnoiter land to which they might migrate. These men, going a day's journey not far from Mount Lebanon and the lesser springs of the Jordan, near the great plain by the city of Sidon, and having surveyed a good and all-productive land, reported back to their own people. Setting out with an army, the Danites founded there a city called Dan, after the name of Jacob's son, from whom their tribe also took its name. For the Israelites, things went from bad to worse, both from inexperience and hardship, and from neglect of religion. For once they had shifted away from the order of their constitution, they were carried toward living as pleasure and private will dictated, so that they even became infected with the evils practiced among the Canaanites. God therefore grew angry with them, and the prosperity they had won through countless labors they lost through indulgence. When Chushan-Rishathaim, king of the Assyrians, marched against them, they lost many of those who fought in the battle line, and besieged were taken by force. Some, out of fear, went over to him voluntarily. Assessed tribute beyond their means, they paid it and endured every kind of outrage for 8 years, after which they were freed from these evils in the following way. A certain man of the tribe of Judah, Othniel by name, a man of action and noble spirit, was told by an oracle not to look on while the Israelites lay under such compulsion, but to dare to deliver them into freedom, urging some to join him in facing the danger. There were few of these, but they felt shame at the present state of things and eagerness for a change. He first destroyed the garrison of Chushan-Rishathaim that was stationed among them, and, as more men joined the struggle once the first stage of the enterprise had succeeded, he joined battle with the Assyrians and, driving them back completely, forced them to cross the Euphrates. Othniel, having thus given proof by deed of his valor, received as a reward for it authority from the people, so as to judge them, and, having ruled for 40 years, ended his life. When he died, the affairs of the Israelites again sickened under lack of leadership, and because they did not honor God nor obey the laws, they suffered still worse. So that, in contempt of their disorderly conduct of their commonwealth, Eglon, king of the Moabites, made war on them, defeated them in many battles, subdued those who excelled the rest in spirit, brought their power entirely low, and imposed tribute upon them. Establishing his royal seat at Jericho, he left no form of oppression untried against the people, and reduced them to poverty for 18 years. Then, taking pity, the God of the Israelites was moved by their sufferings, and, softened by their pleas, delivered them from their humiliation under the Moabites. This is how their freedom came about. Among the tribe of Benjamin there was a young man named Ehud, son of Gera, a man of great daring and physically capable for action, who was stronger with his left hand and relied chiefly on that. He too lived in Jericho, and he grew close to Eglon, courting him with gifts and flattering attentions, so that through this he came to be well regarded by those around the king. On one occasion, bringing gifts to the king with 2 servants, he strapped a short sword secretly to his right thigh and went into him. It was summer, and since it was already midday, the guards had relaxed their watch because of the heat and had turned to their meal. So the young man gave the gifts to Eglon, and since he was spending time in a chamber that was well arranged for summer comfort, they fell into conversation. They were alone, for the king had ordered the attendants who kept entering to leave, since he wished to talk with Ehud. He was sitting on his throne, and Ehud felt afraid that he might miss his aim and fail to deliver a fatal blow. So he made him rise, saying he had something to reveal to him by God's command. And Eglon, delighted at the prospect of the revelation, leaped up from his throne, whereupon Ehud struck him in the heart, left the short sword embedded in the wound, and went out, pulling the door shut behind him. The servants, thinking the king had turned to sleep, remained undisturbed. Ehud then signaled secretly to the people of Jericho and urged them to seize their freedom. They heard him gladly, took up arms themselves, and sent men through the countryside to sound the signal on ram's horns, for it was their custom to summon the people together with these. Eglon's men remained ignorant of what had happened to him for a long time, but when evening came, fearing that some mishap had befallen him, they went into the chamber, found him dead, and stood in helpless confusion. Before the guard could regroup, the mass of the Israelites fell upon them. Some were cut down on the spot, while others turned to flee toward Moab, hoping to find safety there. There were more than 10,000 of them. But the Israelites had already seized the crossing of the Jordan ahead of them, and pursuing them, they killed many at the crossing itself. Not one escaped their hands. In this way, the Hebrews were freed from their servitude under the Moabites, and Ehud, honored for this deed with leadership over the whole people, held that office for 80 years until his death, a man who, apart from the exploit just described, deserved praise in his own right. After him, Shamgar, son of Anath, was chosen to rule, but died in the first year of his office. The Israelites, once again, for they had learned nothing from the discipline of their earlier misfortunes about failing to honor God and obey the laws, before they had even had time to draw breath from their servitude under the Moabites, were enslaved for a short while to Jabin, king of the Canaanites. He, based in the city of Hazor, which lies above Lake Semichonitis, maintained an army of 300,000 infantry, 10,000 cavalry, and had at his disposal 3,000 chariots. Sisera, the commander of this force, held the highest place of honor with the king. And when the Israelites gathered to oppose him, he inflicted terrible harm on them, forcing them to pay tribute. For 20 years they endured this treatment, unable to come to their senses through their misfortune, while God, wishing to humble their arrogance still further on account of their ingratitude toward him. So that, once changed, they might in future learn wisdom, having been taught that their calamities arose from their contempt of the laws. They turned in supplication to a certain prophetess named Deborah, which means bee in the Hebrew tongue, begging her to entreat God to take pity on them and not to look on while they perished at the hands of the Canaanites. God granted them deliverance and chose as their commander Barak, of the tribe of Naphtali. Barak means lightning in the Hebrew tongue. Deborah summoned Barak and ordered him, having chosen 10,000 of the young men, to march against the enemy, for God had declared beforehand that this number would suffice and had foretold victory. "I will not command," Barak replied, "unless you command alongside me." Indignant, she said, "So you would hand over to a woman the honor God has given you? I, for my part, do not refuse it." So, having mustered their 10,000, they encamped near Mount Tabor. Sisera came out to meet them at the king's command and pitched camp not far from the enemy. The Israelites and Barak, terrified at the enemy's numbers, had resolved to withdraw, but Deborah restrained them, urging that the battle be joined that very day, for God would grant them victory and fight on their side. So they engaged, and as the armies closed, a great storm broke, heavy rain and hail, and a wind drove the rain into the faces of the Canaanites, blinding their eyes so that their bows and slings were useless to them, and their heavy infantry, because of the cold, could not wield their swords. The Israelites, by contrast, were far less troubled, since the storm struck them from behind, and, taking courage from the thought of God's aid, they pushed into the midst of the enemy and killed great numbers of them. Some fell at the hands of the Israelites, others, thrown into confusion by their own cavalry, were trampled, so that many died beneath the chariots. Sisera, when he saw the rout beginning, leaped down from his chariot and, fleeing, arrived at the tent of a Kenite woman named Yael, who agreed to hide him at his request, and when he asked for a drink, gave him milk that had already gone sour. Having drunk more than his fill, he fell into a deep sleep. Yael, while he slept, drove an iron tent peg through his mouth and jaw with a hammer, pinning it into the ground, and a little later, when Barak's men arrived, she showed them the body fastened to the earth. And so this victory, as Deborah had foretold, fell to a woman. Barak then marched against Hazor, killed Jabin when he came out to meet him, and after the commander's fall, razed the city to the ground. He led the Israelites for 40 years. After Barak and Deborah died at about the same time, the Midianites, having called in the Amalekites and the Arabs as allies, marched against the Israelites, defeated them in battle, ravaged their crops, and carried off the plunder. Doing this for 7 years, they drove the mass of the Israelites back into the hills, forcing them to abandon the plains and dig tunnels and caves, in which they kept whatever escaped the enemy's notice, guarding it there. For the Midianites, campaigning in the summer season, allowed the Israelites to farm through the winter, so as to have something to plunder once their labor had produced it. There was famine and scarcity of food, and the people turned to supplication, begging God to save them. Gideon, son of Josh, of the tribe of Manasseh, was thrashing a small quantity of sheaves of grain secretly in the winepress, for he was afraid to do so openly at the thrashing floor because of the enemy. A phantom appeared to him in the form of a young man and declared him blessed and beloved by God. "This, at least," he replied, "is a fine token of his favor, that I now have to use a winepress instead of a thrashing floor."